Halo, nama saya Elizabeth Pisani dan saya seorang Inggris tetapi lama di Indonesia dan sangat suka jalan di Indonesia. Dan sekarang ini saya jalan sama Rick Steves. That was Bahasa Indonesia, which is the national language of Indonesia. And what I was saying was, hi, my name's Elizabeth Pisani and I'm English, but I travel a lot in Indonesia and right now I'm traveling with Rick Steves. Halo, nama saya Elizabeth Pisani. Saya seorang Inggris tapi lama jalan di Indonesia. Dan sekarang ini, saya jalan bersama Rick Steves.
I remember past elections when American voters were fond of saying there's not a nickel's worth of difference between the Democratic and the Republican Party. Well, that's not the case this year. It's clear that in 2024, our country's electorate is faced with a big decision. Essentially, it's democracy versus autocracy. And one party is making the case that to get things accomplished, the old democratic status quo is a hindrance. What a lot of Americans don't realize is that Europe is engaged in pretty much the same discussion these days, and that 100 years ago, much of Europe actually elected leaders who promised to end democracy for the promise of a stronger economy, for law and order, and the pledge to make that country, whether Spain or Italy or Portugal or Germany, great again. As a historian and a travel journalist, I believe that lessons from the past and lessons from the road are particularly important considering the issues and the consequences of this year's election here in the United States. Democracies across Europe are divided, like we are right here in the United States, and they're facing the same questions, the same fear of immigrants, the same claims of fake news, and the same promises from right-wing autocrats that they alone can lead their nations into a brighter future. That's why we've invited guides and colleagues from Hungary, Poland, and Portugal to join us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to share their perspectives, not on our political environment, but on their own. We're joined now by Andrea McKay, who lives in Budapest, Hungary, by Tomasz Klimek, who's from Krakow in Poland, and by Claudia da Costa, who lives in Lisbon in Portugal. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Great to be here. So nice to have you here.
And I am just eager to get into this conversation because each of you are living in complicated times like we are here in our democracy. Now, I was recently in Dresden in Germany, and it was a Monday, and I stumbled into a weekly confrontation on the streets. And my guide said, oh, yeah, it's Monday. So there's the people who want this, the equivalent of the MAGA, Make America Great Again kind of thinking, a crowd that was complaining about their government. And then there was a bunch of pro-democracy people on the other side of the square and a bunch of police in the middle to keep order. And this is every Monday experience in this part of Germany. And looking at the flags and feeling the dynamic there in that crowd, I was struck by how it was very much like demonstrations I've witnessed in Turkey, I've witnessed them in Italy, and I've witnessed them in my own country. Do you feel that there's this dynamic in your country also these days? Tomasz from Poland?
So in Poland, being a democratic country, and we fought for this democracy for so long, so we kind of appreciate it even more. It is happening, yes. Sometimes exactly on the same day, in the same city, you'd have two different protests for two completely opposite causes or issues. And of course, it brings up a lot of emotions, but it's happening. And I think it's good it's happening because it is possible for the both sides.
You can talk on the streets. So this is a way to confront these issues and find out what do we really think.
So it was difficult to talk actually in that moment because there are a lot of emotions. And I guess with those emotions, talk is difficult.
But you've already gone, you've swung to the right and now to the left. You had left, then you elected of quite a strong right-wing government, which was sort of, they put you in the same class as Turkey and Hungary and any place that was having a right-wing government. And then you elected them away.
So in Poland, you have to understand that both of those, how you call right and left, they come from the same origin. They come from the origin of solidarity. So in case of Poland, even though we do have swings, we kind of elect them back and forth, this is a very like tiny swing. It's not to all the extreme left and the extreme right. Luckily, we have nothing like this. This is slightly to the right and slightly to the left central and so on. So this is, I hope that
helps. Because when I was in, you were my guide in Poland for 2 weeks as we were filming last year or 2 years ago. And this was during the time that you had your right-wing government. And I was interested in feeling what the pulse was. And it felt pretty good. I felt Poland was Poland.
because it's going the right direction. Because of those swings are not very radical.
Right.
It just kind of continues. It changed right after your visit, actually, because in October, we swung to the left
now,
again.
Andrea, from Hungary, you were famous in communist times as the troublemaking communist country that really had a strong freedom, a passion for freedom, and you were very difficult for Moscow, I think.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So everybody went to Hungary when they couldn't go anywhere else in the Warsaw Pact to get a little dose, a little taste of freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the case. So we really felt as a Western country for the other former communist countries. So let's say Czechoslovakia or Poland. So that was absolutely the case. And
but now you've got more than the little swing that Tomasz was talking about in Poland under Viktor Orban.
That's right.
The first European leader to endorse Donald Trump.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think what is very important to add to what Thomas was saying just before, that in Central Europe, in former communist countries, democracy, the concept of democracy means a totally different thing. When you think about that there are countries in Europe or in other parts of the world where you have experienced hundreds of years of democracy, we don't have that. We had a very turmoil in our history.
Right.
We are not used to how to live in a democratic country. And when Thomas was saying about how people are going out and they are, fighting or they are standing by an idea and then others the opposite, many people in democracy, in these fragile modern democracies, they don't even want to do that or they don't think they can make a change because they are not used to living in democracy.
So are you saying Orban had an easier time derailing freedoms and democracy in Hungary because you didn't really understand how much power you had as a democracy?
So one point is that. The other point is that in countries where you have had hundreds of years of democracy, you do have those checks and balances that you can count on.
Right.
However, after the, let's say, end of communism in Hungary, we were so enthusiastic about the new times, freedom, that we have not put into our constitution those fundamental checks and balances because we never thought that so quickly there will be a certain political power that would want to dismantle democratic institutions.
You see, I think the brilliance of our founding fathers back in the late 1700s was to anticipate that there would be these kind of forces. Autocracy, voices for elites, powerful people that would come in and derail democracy. So we had these checks and balances. And I know from my study of autocratic states, whether far left or right, you need to destroy these checks and balances. And if you look at anybody's, let's just think of whatever autocrat you can think of right now, they have a playbook. And one of those things is to get rid of the checks and balances.
That's right.
So Orban was really good at that when he took power in Hungary.
That's right. So he was the one to realize that this can be done.
Yeah.
Because there are obstacles, but he can overcome those obstacles.
So he's overcome the judiciary.
That's right.
He's overcome free press.
Yes. But on the other hand, what you can... it is definitely, you have to emphasize that it is still a democracy, right?
Right?
Which means that we have free elections, you can express your opinion. So it's a kind of a hybrid system.
So this is one of my very interesting thoughts is it is a democracy. You know, if I don't want Trump to be president, but if 50% of Americans vote for him, so be it. It's a democracy. So, and in your countries also, you believe that people can still vote. And if you have Orban, it's because there's a lot of people that like what Orban has to promise.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. So that he has a very strong base of people that support him.
Yeah.
What he had mastered is to divide the population totally. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of people support him. Many, many people don't support him. However, that's why I'm kind of saying it, that this is like a hybrid system.
Has he attacked the validity, the fairness of the counting of the votes?
So actually, no.
He could be voted out and he would say, okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about how Europeans are seeing the threats to democracy and how the dynamics work and how they relate to our country. We can draw those conclusions from this discussion. We're joined by Andrea McKay from Hungary, Claudia da Costa from Portugal, and Tomasz Klimek from Poland. Now, Claudia, in Portugal, your country is in a little bit different situation than Poland and Hungary, but how do you see the political dynamic in your country right now? because you come out of a Salazar heritage, 50 years of a dictator like Franco, like not quite like Mussolini, but a fascist dictator. And in modern times, we finally got freedom in Portugal.
Yes, we have to understand that Salazar was a fascio, so a fascist, but his ideas were different from Franco, Mussolini, Hitler, all those men that were in power in the time. Salazar was one of the dictators, but we have two dictators. So Salazar was ruling the country between 1928 to 1968. And then we have the second dictator from 68 to 74.
Okay.
His name was Marcelo Caetano. He was not a sweet man, but he was different from Salazar. Salazar was the man, the dictator. So after that, in 1974, yes, we have elections and we have presidents. First of them, they were from the military. And we have a lot of people in Portugal that they still admire Salazar.
Right.
Okay? Because something that a lot of people, they say, is that Portugal didn't participate on the Second World War thanks to him.
Right. So that's a thing to brag about if you have this agenda, is that you stay out of wars.
Yes, because he was dealing with the two sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wanted to be neutral, of course, and this was good for us, we have to say that.
Yeah.
Of course, also for the part of the population was very difficult because Portugal, a lot of the people were starving. And now we have recently, we had elections, and one of the most, I find one of the biggest problems in Portugal, I think a little bit everywhere, is that people don't vote. That is, in my opinion, the worst. In Portugal, yes.
I think that's very interesting. Tomasz, what's the answer in Poland?
So actually in Poland, because we value democracy and this freedom that we had to fight for so long, so our voting rate is one of the highest in the world. Like the past election, it was 74%.
Bravo. Yeah.
And there were some places where it was reaching 90%.
Now, when we think about the promises of a right-wing wannabe autocratic government, the promises that a Salazar or a Mussolini or a Viktor Orban would make, it seems like they're similar. You've got a fear of refugees. You've got complaints about the economy. You've got promises of law and order. You've got Christian nationalism. If you were to sum up, Andrea, in Hungary, what are the promises that Orban makes that causes him to win elections?
So absolutely what is very fundamental is to understand how he can relate to the Hungarian history. So basically he kind of comes up with the idea of protecting Hungary, the integrity of the country, promising to always keep an eye on the interest of the people. If you have a look at examples of, for example, migration into Europe, and he's threatening with the German or the Austrian example of how so many Muslim people were coming into the country, and he was the first one to say no to all the Syrian refugees where they wanted to come into Hungary.
Right.
So always, whatever happens, he has the kind of dynamic to just to keep an eye on what is important for the Hungarian people.
And the Hungarians were worried about immigrants coming over
and,
the border.
Yes, obviously, yes. And so that was the first kind of thing to play the cards, not to let Muslim population into a primarily Christian country, not to let anybody to take away our Hungarian culture and our values and Christianity. So that was how it started out. And as time went on, because he has been in power for 14 years now, so it's quite a long time.
Yeah.
In a way, I would say everything came handy to him. Pandemic, Ukrainian war, all of these were able to make him form a kind of an enemy. And how he is protecting everything and how he is doing everything to provide a safe environment for Hungarian people.
We're getting insider views on democracy and the threats and challenges it faces in Poland, Hungary, and Portugal right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guides are Tomasz Klimek, who lives in Krakow, Poland, Andrea Mackay from Budapest, Hungary, and Claudia da Costa from Lisbon, Portugal. They specialize in showing the highlights of their countries to American visitors, and they're helping us better understand the political issues they face in their countries. To me, Christian and nationalism are two different things, and it's interesting how people put that together for political purposes. Claudia, you're shaking your head, yes. What does Christian nationalism mean to a Portuguese political situation?
You know, I always go back to history, and now, well, I can go back to history and I can back to now to the reality. Salazar was a man that studied to become a priest. And then, I don't know where, there is the link, but he became a dictator. Yeah. So he's a very, he was a very religious man.
So he got the part of the Christian vote, people that were threatened by non-Christian lifestyles.
He had, like you were saying, let's make America great again. Salazar was always saying, Fatima, Fado, and football.
Whoa.
So it was the three Fs of the time of Salazar.
And let's explain to people the importance of those three Fs.
Yes, Fatima, the shrine, of course. Like, again, important.
Super Catholic. We still
are Catholic. Yeah. We still are based in the church. The church has a lot of power.
Yeah.
That's why we had a lot of problems with the referendums for abortion and gays' wedding and those kind of things. And then, obviously, football, I think, in Europe, but Portugal is like, Cristiano Ronaldo is kind of a god for the Portuguese.
This is interesting. I saw the same thing with Maradona in Naples, in the poor parts of Italy. You know, the soccer star was the great equalizer.
Sure.
You know, the poor city could actually have the same number of people on the field as the rich city, and they could get equal because they had the star.
And then just the last F, Fado, I think is because, again, he was a patriot, so... Portugal is important. Traditions are important.
Fado is the traditional music. Tomasz, what about Christian nationalism in Poland, where you have actually had a recent pope come from?
So actually in Poland, situation is a little bit different. Poland has been always very predominantly Catholic country, 96% Catholic, which is a number is difficult to find elsewhere.
Right.
But in Poland, especially under the communism and in those difficult times as Polish history is full of, the church was always supportive of people. So going to church under the communism was a sort of side of rebel. I know people who are atheists and they were going to church on Sunday, like to show the middle finger.
Atheists would show their middle finger by not having a brunch, but by going to church mass on Sunday.
And also after the church Sunday, the intellectuals will meet at the end and discuss important things. So it was a place to be. So this religion.
It was a very symbolic statement.
Yeah. Exactly. Against not the government, against the regime, against the communism.
Regime. I gotcha. Yeah.
So it's still very powerful. Of course, numbers are dropping, which is always happening when you get more money, the richer the country gets, the religion kind of drops down. And we see it, but still it's a very slow process and still religion is important. And none of those directions of the swing would dare to kind of touch that because one of the prime ministers from the central left-wing party, actually just before the elections, he took official church marriage just to be able to...
Had to be kind of is the credentials for
credentials
him.
for the Christian electorate. So you see, it's a little bit of a different side.
There's more in just a moment on the issues Andrea, Claudia, and Tomasz are facing in their countries and what it's been like lately to promote democratic ideals in Hungary, Portugal, and Poland. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves.